You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Viktor Yanukovych claims to be still president of the country that he appears reluctant to set foot in. Increasing numbers of armed men who could very easily be mistaken for Russian soldiers appear less hesitant. We'll discuss another eventful day in Ukrainian history with Ben Judah and Raffaello Pantucci. Also ahead, we'll be in Montreal, where the Parti Québécois are continuing to wage the least urgent liberation struggle in human history. We'll have the latest from our correspondent, Patrick Pittman.
They have fought a lot of struggles, and they're not particularly used to being in the majority, and so they still act as though they are an oppressed minority a lot of the time. And you see that now in these urgent emergencies that pop up to fight things. And, you know, the thing is, electorally in Quebec, it kind of works.
We will, of course, bring you some music as well, and... we'll have a special edition of our weekly film review, casting our eyes ahead to Sunday and the Academy Awards ceremony in Hollywood. All that and more besides coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. So lots coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from Midori House. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry has today warned Russia not to inflame the situation in Ukraine and raise questions about reports of Russian armored vehicles and personnel there. Armed men took control of two airports in the Crimea region of Ukraine earlier on Friday in what the new Ukrainian leadership described as a Russian invasion. More than 10 Russian military helicopters flew into Ukrainian airspace on Friday over Crimea, Kiev's Border Guard Service said, accusing Russian servicemen of blockading one of its units in the port city of Sevastopol, where part of Moscow's Black Sea Fleet is based. Meanwhile, the head of the International Monetary Fund said on Friday that there was no need to panic about delivering economic aid to Ukraine. Christine Lagarde also said that next week will involve a fact-finding mission to find ways to support the country.
Next week is fact-finding, beginning of a dialogue, preliminary assessment and discussion of the building blocks of what programs could be put in place in order to support Ukraine. I think it's highly premature to assess financial needs, numbers here, numbers there. We need to rely on facts.
Meanwhile, the ousted Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych appeared in public for the first time after a week on the run, saying he would not give up the fight for his country's future. In the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don, he said he'd been forced from power by what he called nationalist pro-fascist gangsters and blamed the crisis on the West for indulging protesters seeking his overthrow. Gunmen from the Islamist sect Boko Haram have shot dead at least 12 people during a four-hour siege on villages in northeast Nigeria. Boko Haram, whose fight for an Islamic state in northern Nigeria, has killed thousands and made them the biggest threat to security in Africa's top oil producer, is increasingly preying on the civilian population. The Philippines President Benigno Aquino has urged a peaceful solution to the South China Sea dispute during a state visit to Malaysia on Friday. China claims about 90% of the million square mile resource-rich waters situated in the south of China and surrounding several Southeast Asian nations. Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam and Taiwan also claim parts of the sea.
The Prime Minister and I agreed on the peaceful settlement of disputes in the West Philippine Sea and the South China Sea in accordance with the rule of law and the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. We believe that adherence to the rule of law, positive engagement, and sincere dialogue are fundamental if we are to build a truly prosperous and peaceful Southeast Asia.
A fire that's been burning for nearly 3 weeks at a coal mine in Australia has prompted local authorities to urge some vulnerable residents to leave the area amid growing concerns about health effects. The Morwell South area, around 100 miles from Melbourne, has had poor air quality since the 9th of February when a fire started burning at the nearby Hazelwood coal mine. Well, Dr. Rosemary Lester is Victoria's Chief Health Officer.
People who are in the particular at-risk groups, so those over 65, children under school age, pregnant women, and anyone with a pre-existing heart or lung condition, our advice is that they temporarily relocate outside the area. Now, I must stress this is precautionary advice only. The air quality has not gone up significantly. There is no significant increase in the danger today.
And finally, in Sweden, police had to disperse an angry crowd of job seekers outside an employment office in Stockholm after it called 61,000 people for a recruitment meeting by mistake. The acting director of management, Klas Olsson, admitted it was a very messy situation. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's coming up for 18:06 here in London. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24 and you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06, which will make it 13:06 in New York. Joining me now in the studio with their take on today's news are Ben Judah and Raffaello Pantucci. Welcome both to the programme. We will start today in Ukraine, where today has been eventful, even by recent standards, having cunningly distracted everyone by assuring that it would never interfere in Ukraine's internal affairs. Russia has been interfering in Ukraine's internal affairs. Despite Moscow's denials, gentlemen wearing what look remarkably like Russian uniforms, carrying what look remarkably like Russian weapons, and driving what look remarkably like Russian military vehicles have been turning up at various installations in Crimea. Meanwhile, ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych gave a somewhat bewildered press conference at which, among other things, he said he was against outside military involvement and that he was still the legitimate president of Ukraine, both of which appear to be fairly redundant observations at this point. Ben Judah, I'll start with you. How far is Russia likely to push this?
Well, the thing about Vladimir Putin is he always does what you don't think he'd be capable of, the fear of the West. If we go right back to the beginning of Vladimir Putin's career, no one believed that he would jail the richest man in Russia, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and he did it. No one believed that Putin would invade Georgia to stop NATO expansion, he did it. No one believed that Vladimir Putin would return to the presidency, and he did it. And intervention in Crimea was one of those things that we believed that Vladimir Putin would not do for fear of the West.
And nobody believed, of course, that he would lead a migration of wild geese from a hang glider, and he did that as well. You mentioned there the invasion of Georgia in 2008. Is this a comparable situation? You talked there about how Russia waded into Georgia to sort of rock NATO back on its heels slightly. Do you think they're trying to send the same warning to the EU?
Yes. Like, Russia believed that NATO expansion would tear away its former Soviet colonies away from it forever and that it needed to take drastic action to prevent NATO membership for Ukraine and for Georgia. And that afterwards, Russian officials were toasting with champagne the victory that defeated NATO expansion. And Putin and Medvedev have said repeatedly, we defeated NATO expansion by force of arms, as we called their bluff. The mistake they made is that they never took the EU seriously. They believe the EU is some sort of useless trading organisation. They've clearly been taking advice from British MEPs. And it was only too late that they realised that EU membership isn't you host a referendum and bang, you're in. The EU has a whole waiting chamber called the Eastern Partnership, where your entire state is rebuilt up to EU standards, which means you can't join any Russian club that Putin wanted to build. So what we're seeing is not just with the intervention in Crimea, but going right back to the way Russia forced Yanukovych with threat of a trade war not to sign any deal with the EU, Russia taking extreme measures to stop the EU inking the first stage of the of a lengthy integration process with Ukraine.
Raffaello, I'll come to you with a variation on the same question. There will be people sitting around tables in important rooms all over London, Brussels and Washington tonight wondering what on earth is going on and what they're expected to do about it. Scrutinising the runes that we have seen spilled today, what do we learn about Vladimir Putin's intentions here?
I would agree with Ben that it's actually very difficult to predict exactly what he's going to do. I think he's proven himself repeatedly in the past to be a kind of unpredictable leader. I mean, in retrospect, we look and we say, well, that was predictable. But I think at the time it seems uncertain. I would, however, be a little... I'm less hawkish in terms of believing that he might actually go beyond what we've already seen them doing in military terms. And I think to go as far as to do what they did in Georgia previously, I think would be very surprising. I think the dynamic on the ground does feel somewhat different. In Georgia, you didn't have a country that was divided so clearly between a population who wanted to be part of Russia and a population who didn't, which is more what you have here. And I think even if we look at what sort of Yanukovych seems to be saying, he is still keen to retain his authority over the country in some way. And I think he still talks about it as though he would like to continue to rule over a unified country. I think he had that previously in the past when he got voted in, that he had to rule over this entire country, which has always had this sort of fissure at its heart. And so I wonder how much Putin would really want to push it in a direction of ripping the whole place apart by sending force of, you know, a massive invasion force in the same way that we saw in Georgia.
You mentioned President Viktor Yanukovych there, who we will discuss in more detail shortly. But last night on The Daily, we spoke to Dr. Igor Suchagin, who is a former Russian intelligence operative who now works with you, Raffaello, at the Royal United Services Institute. This is what he had to say about how Russia might be viewing Yanukovych's presence in their country.
The more interesting thing is what his Russian colleagues can tell him and why they want to keep him. And it seems that it's a sort of plan B for the Kremlin, because they do realize that there is terribly a high probability that this new Ukrainian government will fail or will have terrible difficulties in the nearest future. And it seems that Russia, the Kremlin, will help the Ukrainian government to have those troubles.
Ben Judah, coming back to you on the subject of Viktor Yanukovych, is he still a player here? Is he a complete irrelevance at this point?
Well, Yanukovych in his press conference today looked bewildered, confused, at times frightened and in denial. And he repeatedly said that Putin had not had any time to meet him, that they'd only had a phone conversation. And even though when asked what his views were on possible military intervention and did he support support Russia intervening into Ukraine, he said no. What he did say is that Mr. Putin, knowing him, having worked with him, Mr. Putin is a very, very decisive man, and I'm surprised he hasn't taken more decisive measures. So there were signals to Putin that Yanukovych would like him to do something. Is Yanukovych likely to return to Ukrainian political life? I think not. I think a very interesting fact that's happened over the past 24 hours is that Yanukovych's finances are now under attack in Austria, and money laundering investigations have been opened against him. So I think Yanukovych is finished as a Ukrainian politician. What I think the big risk right now is in Ukraine is, if you're watching the videos of the Ukrainian parliament, you have confusion, people sort of clapping, passing laws, not knowing what the reaction would be. And one thing that's been missing in the Western narrative is that the Ukrainian parliament, in a fit of jubilation, dropped Russian as an official language.
That was tactful.
This tactful measure, respecting a not inconsiderable minority of ethnic Russians in the country and a not inconsiderable majority of Russian speakers in the country, is what Russian officials say has provoked their moves to defend installations in Crimea. And there's fear from Russian diplomats that a overexcited revolutionary leader in Kiev could announce that he would send in the troops or send in the riot police to restore order in Crimea. So I think that the EU right now should be telling the Ukrainians to keep calm and do nothing.
Okay, well, there's a couple of points there we'll address shortly, but this is a bit more from Dr. Igor Suchagin again last night on The Daily. This is on reflection on how Yanukovych's current exile is a precedent for other beleaguered world leaders who might be tempted to look to Moscow for assistance.
If they will fire Yanukovych, leave him without any support, what will they tell tomorrow to Bashar al-Assad when he will come back to Moscow? To all others whom Russia tried to control now? These people, if they will send Yanukovych back to Kyiv, these guys around the world will think twice whether it's a good idea to deal with Moscow.
That was Dr. Igor Sich again last night. Raffaello Pantucci, I'll come back to you with a variation on this question. Does Yanukovych actually have a plausible option at this point? He's done, isn't he?
I don't know. I mean, I think Ben's probably right. It would be surprising if we saw Viktor Yanukovych return to Ukrainian politics.
There again, but people probably saying this when he got turfed out of office.
Well,
the
that's
first
what
time.
I was going to say. And, yeah. You know, even with Yulia Tymoshenko, you know, when she was thrown in jail, there was a sense of, well, that was the end of her. And then she appeared. And it's true that my understanding is that her speech in the square wasn't sort of met with rapturous applause. It was
booze.
You know, it was booze. Well, there you go. So I think she's not particularly, she doesn't necessarily going to rise up. And I have a sense that from at least the narratives that one hears, at least out of Kiev, I mean, the difficulty is that it's difficult to know whether these narratives are universal to the country if we're just hearing voices out of the square. So the sort of people who naturally hit it. But there does seem to be a sense of anger at the sort of ancien regime. And Yanukovych is part of that in as much as Tymoshenko is. So it would be surprising. But again, I think, as you point out, we've seen this happen before. It could happen again.
I want to move on shortly to the international perspective on today's developments. First of all, this is John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, speaking earlier.
We urge all parties, that includes the new interim technical government and rightists and oppositionists and others, anybody in the street who is armed, we urge all parties to avoid any steps that could be misinterpreted or lead to miscalculation, or do anything other than to work to bring peace and stability and peaceful transition within the governing process of Ukraine.
That was John Kerry there, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying absolutely all the things you would expect a U.S. Secretary of State to say at this moment. Last night, we heard also from the Supreme Commander of NATO Europe, General Breedlove, who's saying that he just didn't see that NATO and Russia needed to get into any sort of conflict over the future of Ukraine. Is this the United States as tactfully as possible? And Raffaello, I'll put this question to you first. Trying to find a tactful way of saying that they just don't have a dog in this fight?
I don't think it's very tactful. I think it's quite blunt. I don't think they're masking their intent. They've got no intention of getting dragged into a fight. It's the same issue in some ways that we saw with Georgia. In Georgia, there's a call from the Georgians for their NATO allies and friends to come and help them, and no one did. You know, eventually the French president helped sort of moderate some end to the sort of violence there, but you know, they didn't come surging through as was expected. And I think for a lot of countries, there was a perception afterwards, at least in the sort of former Soviet belt, that you know, what is this NATO membership we're sort of trying to reach towards? Is it actually going to do us any benefit? And, you know, Ukraine was never a member of NATO, right? It's remained, I think it does the Partnership for Peace, and it's involved yes. in some of the other sort of bilateral friendship partnerships that NATO has, but it's not really a full-fledged member. You know, and I think from a NATO perspective, they would say, well, that means that we don't, you know, we're not constitutionally mandated to react when something's happened. And I think this is just to clarify that. I think the last thing they want, and maybe I suppose we go back to the Georgia example here, there was some accusation that the West has sort of goaded Saakashvili into doing this by suggesting we're going to come and help out. I think here by saying it so bluntly, they're saying we're not going to come and get involved. So, you know, don't start pushing, as Ben points out, for some overexcited leader to suddenly push ahead for some armed conflict and the expectation the NATO forces are going to come and back him up, which they're simply not going to do.
Ben Judah, an international perspective from a little bit closer to home. We saw the EU getting involved in Kiev a couple of weeks ago, which now seems like a bizarrely long time after the trouble in the Maidan yes. to broker some sort of peace accord. Now that we do have, despite official Russian denials, what is unmistakably Russian military forces on Ukrainian territory, does the EU have a role here other than just to keep out of this?
I had a very interesting meeting with a very, very, very senior member of the Commission a few days ago, who shall not be named, who said that there was a 50-50 risk of Russia taking the extreme measures. And so what he said I thought was the most interesting is the EU was too frightened to sign any document with Ukraine, bringing it close to the European Union, such as the association agreement, because otherwise it will be like inviting him into Crimea. So it seems that he who must not be named is already in Crimea. So the EU's worst fears have materialised.
We will talk shortly about the future of Ukraine, the immediate and long term. Before that, this is Dr. Igor Sich again speaking on Monocle 24 last night, suggesting that some sort of cooperation between Russia and Europe, ironically enough, might be the only way of keeping Ukraine in one piece.
Actually, the division line is the people who look to the future and people who look to the past. So Soviets and Ukrainians. if Russia will really cooperate with EU and will help to modernize Ukraine. Ukraine was in limbo for 24 years since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. If the Russia and the EU will help Ukraine to find its new future, modernized and inevitably brighter future than current gray or maybe even bloody situation, it will be the solution. Because even those Soviets living in Ukraine, they do not want to live in Russia. They want to live in the Soviet Union. So if the situation will improve in Ukraine, that will be good. That will be great for them and they will be satisfied.
There is an interesting point there in that while a measure of chaos in Ukraine does give Russia something to work with in furthering its own interests, complete chaos in Ukraine would be a disaster for Russia. It would be all kinds of disasters. So the question I want to, I guess, end this particular part of the discussion with, a short answer from each of you, is say this time next year, whose flag do we think will be flying over Crimea?
I think it will remain a Ukrainian flag. It would be very surprising. Maybe I'm underestimating the sort of Russian impetus and push and want to actually really take this territory. But I sense that it will remain a Ukrainian flag, but, you know, maybe there will be a Russian one sort of fluttering somewhere nearby.
Ben Judah?
I think Russia wants to create a de facto Russian enclave within Ukrainian territory, but will not take and it will not recognise its independence or do much more than it's done today. Because what Russia wants is to create chaos in Ukraine that will prevent it moving towards the European Union at any speed and destabilise it. And lurking in the background is the fact that Ukraine is teetering on the brink of default. And this intervention is about distracting the government, destroying not only territorial integrity, but also the currency.
And Russia keeps a stick to poke the West with.
Precisely.
Ben Judah and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you for the moment. When we return, we will be continuing our discussion of the day's top stories. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and still with me is the author Ben Judah and Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute. Now, it's probably the most significant military development of the War on Terror era, the ability of increasing numbers of technologically advanced countries to wage war from half a world away at almost zero risk to their own personnel flying unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. But what are the limits of their legality, especially when the United States orders them knowingly into action against their own citizens? Ben Judah, I'll start with you. We're asking this question, of course, because of the case of Abdullah al-Shami, who is a US-born militant believed to be somewhere in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. The US are currently debating sending a drone to go and get him. Is it really that bad an idea? It doesn't really seem that there's a better option, does there?
I think it's important to just begin by talking about how Afghanistan and Pakistan have been shaped by the drone war in ways that we don't realise. Is that our image of the Afghan war is frozen where it was 10 years ago with troops on the ground and clashes on the ground. But today, drones and these mysterious humming robots that shoot from the air have so influenced Afghan society that in Afghan love poetry, drones are now a very important metaphor. And one of the most popular Afghan love poems of the past few years has been, "I will follow you like a drone, my love."
That's an image to conjure with, certainly. Raffaello, this has happened before, of course, when the United States whacked Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in 2011.
And then his son.
Obama has acknowledged that 4 Americans have been droned, but only Awlaki was actually targeted. What are the potential legal issues here for the United States?
Well, I mean, the legal issues are the U.S. Forces targeting their own people when targeting U.S. nationals. And, you know, this is very much where the debate is frozen. I mean, in some ways, I think there's something worrying about this whole conversation, because it somehow seems to suggest that sort of American citizens' lives are of greater concern than, you know, other foreign nationals. There have been Germans, there have been British nationals who've also been killed in drone strikes.
Many, many Afghan and Pakistani nationals.
And Yemeni. Thousands. And, you know, it's, I think, unknown numbers, frankly. But I think the point is that here, very much the conversation in the States is very much stuck around this debate of, well, can we target an American national, you know, who we think is doing, who we think is involved in terrorist activity out there? And that's very much where the debate's stuck. And I think this kind of reflects a bigger problem that you have with the whole drone debate in the States, which is there's not really that much recognition of the impact that this is having on U.S. foreign policy and the perception, not necessarily the actual impact, but the perception of U.S. foreign policy. Drones were initially seen as a sort of a tool that could be used. And it's a tool that steadily became a tactic. And so it became the only tactic that they discovered they could actually use in sort of counterterrorism terms, because, you know, when you're dealing with a part of the world like the Fatah or some of the sort of tribal areas of Yemen, it's very difficult to actually get assets on the ground. And so using drones, it's much more easy to do it without any sort of that much of a cost impact in terms of U.S. Casualties. But I think what's interesting over the past year is that this debate has started to shift, and they have started to think, well, what are the actual implications of this? And you have seen actually over the past year, there has been a substantial drop off in the use of drones in Pakistan in particular, and also in Afghanistan to some degree as well. We still see them being used, but we see them apparently being used more judiciously. And we see how the debate in the States has now returned to this very, very specific debate about whether we can target U.S. nationals. I think what's again missing from this whole conversation in the States is how this has really started to shape the perception of U.S. foreign policy internationally. And that element really hasn't registered back at home.
A brief thought from you, if you could, on this, Ben. Ben Judah, that is. Is this just an area in which the law is still yet to catch up with technology?
Yes, I'd agree. But just to play devil's advocate on this show, I think I'd like to sound very supportive of drone warfare. And I think that if we are going to reckon with the reality, that is, should we go after these people? Should we go after these dangerous international terrorists with large numbers of troops whose lives will be put at risk and run costly occupations on the ground and romp through village after village, traumatizing unknown numbers of children, men and women? Or shall we use drones? I think even though the legality may not be maybe grey, and even though the reality is, of course, is in war never pretty, I support the use of drones.
Okay, well, we're going to move finally along tonight to that rancorous sitcom couple, China and Japan. In the latest snipe in the incessant squabbling between the pair, China has floated the idea of national holidays commemorating the anniversary of Japan's rampage through Nanjing in 1937 and Japan's surrender at the end of World War II. Raffaello, I'll come to you first, because it seems like we do talk about a variation on this subject every week. Why do they do this? Why do they do this? Is there a constructive end in sight, or is this just force of habit for both of them at this point?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think we've got to remember these are national politicians playing to national audiences at the end of the day. And I think that's a big element that I think we often miss. I think when we look at the Abe, Abe government in Japan, you know, this is a pretty nationalist government. So for them to sort of tweak the Chinese, it does play to their key constituency. I think for Xi Jinping in Beijing, he's in the middle of a sort of period, again, where Beijing is horribly polluted, and there's a whole question about the average life expectancy dropping substantially due to this polluted air. You know, this is a sort of a useful, thing to fall back on. You can always poke at the Japanese. You know, there's always a Japanese sort of button you can press in the public domain, and it will always attract a certain rally attention.
Well, even by the standards of this dialogue, this is pretty unsubtle stuff. China wants to call the 3rd of September Victory Day of the Chinese People's War of Resistance against Japanese aggression, and 13th of December will be known as National Memorial Day to commemorate those killed by Japanese aggressors during the Nanjing Massacre, which is catchy. Ben, is part of the problem here that Japan and the Japanese people still don't actually fully appreciate or acknowledge what happened in China in the 1930s?
Well, yeah, and I think perhaps also Western commentators. I like to give a kind of dissenting view here, which is I'm Jewish, my family suffered horrendously in Europe in the Second World War, and if I saw German officials going to the shrine of Himmler in Berlin, I'd be extremely offended and extremely upset. And I would support the State of Israel using every opportunity to highlight the fact that Germany had not come to terms with its massacres. The Rape of Nanking was one of the most horrendous war crimes of the 20th century. I've read about it. It's, you know, these descriptions of, like, sexual depravity and the use of rape as a weapon of war make one sick to the stomach. And why shouldn't China have a Rape of Nanking Day?
Well, on that subject, Raffaello, Japan is shortly to review its 1993 Kono statement on comfort women, such as it was. Now, in which direction are they likely to review it?
One would hope they're going to review it in a more conciliatory way. I think, the Japanese government has apologized a number of times. And the thing I would say about this is, the Chinese, the Rape of Nanking Day is an interesting new development. But, the Americans have a Victory Over Japan Day, to celebrate their success in the Pacific. So I think that one we can put to one side. I think there is still a perception when we're talking about the Rape of Nanking that we're doing something that's particularly evil. I mean, I've been to the Yasukuni Shrine and I've been to the Nanjing Memorial. And I mean, when you go to the Nanjing Memorial, it's a huge compound that is really, the stories that you see people telling of things that happened and pictures that were taken are really horrendous. 300,000 people killed in the space of, I think, a few days. And then you go look at the Yasukuni Shrine and you see the Japanese description of it is sort of one line in a long wall that says, there was the Nanjing incident where we took the city and, the civilians, the soldiers took their uniforms off. So we had no choice but to kill basically everyone we could find. This doesn't sort of help. And when you're talking about these sorts of things as part of the national history, it is problematic. But I think that there is, I do think that this is a lot of government sort of stirring things up for their own political constituencies rather than anything that they're really going to follow through in a substantial way.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. Ben Judah and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco
24. Orlando, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And there's plenty coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in Quebec and bringing you a look ahead to this weekend's Academy Awards ceremony in Hollywood. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The US Secretary of State, John Kerry, has today warned Russia not to inflame the situation in Ukraine and raised questions about reports of Russian armoured vehicles and personnel there. Armed men took control of two airports in the Crimea region of Ukraine earlier today in what the new Ukrainian leadership described as a Russian invasion. Gunmen from the Islamist sect Boko Haram have shot dead at least 12 people during a four-hour siege on villages in northeast Nigeria. Boko Haram, whose fight for an Islamic state in northern Nigeria has killed thousands and made them the biggest threat to security in Africa's top oil producer, is increasingly preying now on the civilian population. The Philippines president has urged a peaceful solution to the South China Sea dispute during a state visit to Malaysia on Friday. China claims about 90% of the million square mile resource-rich waters situated in the south of China and surrounding several Southeast Asian nations. And a fire that's been burning for nearly 3 weeks now at a coal mine in Australia has prompted local authorities to urge some vulnerable residents to leave the area amid growing concerns about health effects. The Morwell South area, about 100 miles from Melbourne, has had poor air quality since the 9th of February when a fire started burning at the nearby Hazelwood coal mine. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House live on Monocle 24. It is now 21:33 near enough in Moscow, which will be 18:33 in London, 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Montreal and our correspondent there, Patrick Pittman. I spoke to him a short while ago. We began by discussing the fragile state of Quebecois politics as a snap election looms.
Well, the thing is, we all thought it was going to be called this week. We're about a year or so ahead of schedule, but Pauline Marois's minority government really kind of wants a mandate to push things further. She put a budget forward last week that was defeated. We all thought that'd be a trigger, but seemed to be on hold a little bit.
You talk about a budget going forward. Did it have any constructive ideas in it? Because if we think that all elections are decided usually on the economy, and they usually are, Parti Québécois doesn't have much of a leg to stand on at the moment, do they?
Not particularly, no. It would be one thing to say that finances aren't particularly their strong spot. This budget was... Nobody was pretending that this budget was a real budget. They may as well have just scribbled it on a napkin.
But Parti Québécois have resuscitated their slightly tired old tropes of banging on about identity politics and making somewhat unsavoury pronouncements about the need to preserve Québécois identity and nationality, as if anybody was seriously proposing to take it away from them.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that a lot of people here say, you know, the Francophone, the Parti Québécois in the past, you know, they have fought a lot of struggles and they're not particularly used to being in the majority. And so they still act as though they are an oppressed minority a lot of the time. And you see that now in these urgent emergencies that pop up to fight things such as hijabs and the like. And, you know, the thing is, electorally in Quebec, it kind of works.
But who does this sort of rhetoric play to? I mean, I haven't personally been to Quebec for about 20 years, but last time I was there was not long after the previous election referendum, and I was struck even then by the extraordinary paranoia and persecution complex of what really, by any standards, given that this is Canada and everything, must amount to some of the most, you know, fortunate people on earth.
Absolutely. And, you know, perfectly situated. Quebec is a wonderful province full of resources and the like. But, you know, outside of Montreal, this stuff plays really, really well. You've got to think that as well as Quebec being very separate from the rest of Canada, Montreal is very separate from the rest of Quebec, and it's outside of here that things really play like this.
So talk to me a bit more about this other, I guess, manifestation of this paranoia and persecution complex, which is the language issue in Quebec, and that English-speaking people, or at least people who don't speak French, are saying they feel increasingly uncomfortable in the province.
Again, this is a thing that's been going on forever since the 70s, when the Parti Québécois, or the precursors, did fight to, you know, actually get some primacy back for the French language, which had been lost at the time. But, you know, this has manifested over the years in many, many sort of hilarious enforcements of it. Last year's fining of an Italian restaurant for using the word pasta on his menu.
I remember that one with particular joy, yes.
Joy is one word that you could use for it. But this week's one is the minister responsible for this in the Parti Québécois has come out and said that if they do win re-election, that she's going to make her first priority to fight the scourge of the use of the phrase bonjour, hi, in downtown Montreal. Horrible bilingualism.
That's going to be her first priority.
Yes, it's urgent.
Clearly. And just for those of us whose minds are boggling somewhat at this point, bonjour, hi is a problem because...
Because what that is, basically, it's the law here that you need to provide service in French in business. Bonjour, hi is used by downtown businesses in Montreal who have a much more bilingual clientele. It's basically an offer to, you know, do business in your language of choice without breaking the rules. But the thing is, it's a bit of a workaround of the rules and they don't like that.
But again, this is the thing that struck me on that visit that I'm talking about. It's not like anybody is proposing to stop anybody in Montreal or even anywhere else in Quebec from speaking French if they feel like it.
No, I mean, there is the reality that if this wasn't enforced through some kind of legislation, then business in North America would naturally drift towards English. And there is an argument that if you want to protect the French language, you do need to make some protections there. But it tends to go a lot further than that in how they enforce it. And, you know, they have language police that go from business to business running spot checks and those sorts of things.
Well, we should move along, I guess, to a slightly more serious Parti Québécois policy, at least. Well, by definition, because on the grounds that any policy is going to be more serious than any of those. This is their Dying with Dignity bill. Where is that going now?
Well, you know, they've been working on this for 4 years. It would have been very pioneering. And, you know, say what you like about the Parti Québécois. They do have some very progressive social policies, healthcare policies and the like. And this would have made a great deal of difference. Unfortunately, it's kind of been caught up in all of that electioneering we're talking about. And it didn't actually make it to vote before Parliament lapsed. There was this kind of race to the line to get it over. But the opposition were deliberately stalling with, I guess, what you'd call in America, filibusters of the bill.
And this is the so-called Bill 52, which would permit a framework by which doctors could medically assist with death. They were very careful to avoid the phrase euthanasia. Was this widely popular in Quebec, or was it quite divisive? I'm guessing and this is an assumption I'm making, that in what is a fairly substantially Catholic part of the country, there could be problems with this.
Well, the place of religion in Quebec is an interesting thing, because though there is that really strong Catholic heritage, it's a proudly secular state. And this bill, I mean, a euthanasia bill, or whatever you want to call it, is always going to be divisive regardless of where it is in the world. But generally, this was supported on all sides of politics. So it's quite a surprise that it hasn't gone through as yet.
Okay, and finally, we should move along to a story we've covered a bit on Monocle 24 with a certain amount of dismay, because by and large, as an institution, we're in favour of things like bike sharing technology. But Bixi, which is one of the pioneers of the technology, has not found a way to make it pay.
No, and this is the company who invented the tech that in London is the Boris bike. You know, they sold this to London, they sold it to New York, Toronto, Chicago, Washington, Melbourne. You know, 4 million rides a year in Montreal, and yet they're currently undergoing bankruptcy hearings.
So what happened? How did they fail to make money out of that kind of uptake?
Well, I mean, to understand that, you sort of have to understand Montreal as well and the way business gets done here, which is largely in back rooms, even in city councils. This is a sort of quasi-public corporation, where money disappears in the way it will with the city of Montreal, at least historically. And, you know, the books for this corporation were closed for many years. They were burning a lot of money in trying to expand internationally rather than focusing on building a working system at home. There were some disputes with a software company that, as these things go, they tried to build their own software, sold that to other cities, didn't work at all. Other cities, including New York, ended up suing them.
So is there any future at all for Bixi, or is the thing just going to dwindle?
Well, there's two separate parts to that. In Montreal itself, the new mayor here, Denis Coderre, who is trying to draw a line under a lot of those practices of the past, he's agreed to, even though that Bixi owe the city something like $40 million, he's agreed to take on its Montreal operations and run those under the city's umbrella. What happens with the international business, it's a bit tougher to say. That they're trying to sell it off, but I think everybody that's looked at the books so far has run away screaming.
It was Patrick Pittman, Monocle's Montreal correspondent. Up next, we'll be heading to Caracas, which, after some of the most violent protests in Venezuela's recent memory, is looking forward to a somewhat uneasy Mardi Gras. Stay tuned. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Weekly is our hard-hitting Sunday show. Our highly disciplined presenters are fearless in pursuit of the big stories. They're not afraid to say exactly what's on their mind.
Going back 400 to 500 years, which is where I'm beginning my research, which is where I believe tailoring was born.
Tights. Come on, it's all going to say tights here.
Asking the big questions.
Before we go any further, do you find sewing sexy?
Sewing?
Tackling the big concepts.
I've always thought of a Yule log as being like a chocolate log. But in fact, who go to the forest?
Never lost for a word.
It's like a sort of, I don't know how you describe it, like kind of the organ that would be on a Chris Rea B-side.
They're known for their globally minded approach to news.
A bit of a sort of Russian flavour, doesn't it? Or something, I don't know.
It could be a bit of Commander Burano, whatever it is.
Yeah. Commander Burano.
Yeah,
Carmina
exactly.
Burana.
Exactly, yeah.
They shun the frivolous world of celebrity.
Best of times, worst of times, age of reason, age of folly. You're hot, then you're cold, you yes, then you're no. We fight, we break up, we kiss, we make up.
Who knew that Katy Perry was just like Charles Dickens?
Handling the heavyweight news topics with the reverence they deserve.
And now he's moving around with like the gentleness of a Japanese flower arranger.
So, for the most rigorous, probing, and occasionally light-hearted look at the week just ended, tune in to the Monocle Weekly, each Sunday on Monocle 24.
Things can only go uphill from here, I feel.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Yesterday was the beginning of a week-long holiday in Venezuela, and few of the country's citizens will have welcomed a break as ardently as beleaguered President Nicolas Maduro, who has recently been the focus and target of Venezuela's biggest protests in at least a decade. But will Carnival Week give him a rest, or just provide Venezuelans with more time to demonstrate their grievances? I'm joined now from Caracas by our woman there, Irena Caselli. Irena, first of all, what is the latest on the protests? How are they still going?
The protests are still going, but in Caracas, at least, they are definitely less intense than in previous days. We're hearing reports from other parts of the city, of the country, where protests are definitely still quite strong, especially in the border states of Táchira, in the city of San Cristobal on the border with Colombia. But here in Caracas, it seems that so far at least the holidays are definitely having an effect. That said, there are still students in some parts of eastern Caracas that are blocking the roads. They've actually put up some fake palm trees saying this is our beach for this holiday, because the president has, during one of his last speeches actually said, please Venezuelans, enjoy your holidays, go to the beach and enjoy our Caribbean beaches.
Well, that is the key question. Is it possible to tell yet what people are going to do? Are they going to head for the seashore as usual, or are they going to stay in Caracas and carry on telling their president how much they don't like him?
Well, at this point in Caracas, it seems that things are quieter, but there is a big student demonstration planned for Sunday. So I think the students are trying to keep the momentum going. It may be hard in this context. And also, let's not forget that the president has called for a peace conference on Wednesday, which was not attended by the opposition, but it was attended by businessmen, by the leader of the leaders of the biggest businesses here in Venezuela. And there may be some negotiations going on at that level, which may really make a difference, because let's not forget that one of the main concerns of the protesters is actually the state of the economy.
And is the carnival in Caracas, are there events or parades planned as part of it, and are they going to go ahead as usual?
There aren't parades planned like in Brazil, for example, and actually the opposition has criticized the president for trying to put up such a festive sort of air to carnival. A couple of days ago during one of the televised events that are typical here, the president said that Venezuelans had to celebrate carnival in all of its flair, and there were images of women dressed up for carnival. And the opposition criticized that, saying that after all, the president should be a bit more mournful because at least 13 people have died since protests started.
There's another potentially important or emotional date coming up next week, which is the March the 5th anniversary of the death of Hugo Chavez. What is being planned by way of commemoration of that?
There are many events planned. Among them, there are several foreign leaders that are coming, and the main events will take place in the Cuartel de la Montaña, which is the military headquarters where Hugo Chavez's remains are. And today I was there, for example, and they're trying to clean up the area. They're putting up more images of the president, of President Chavez. And also Oliver Stone will be premiering his documentary on Hugo Chavez. And he'll do that during events on March the 5th here in Caracas.
Irene Caselli in Caracas, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for some music, and before we head to a preview of this weekend's Academy Awards, we'll have an Oscar-themed tune. This was triumphant in the original song category of last year's ceremony. This is Skyfall from the incomprehensible Bond film of the same name by Adele. Skyfall there by Adele, winner of the 2012 Oscar for Best Original Song, leading us as smoothly, it says here, as the hem of a dress sweeping along a red carpet. Champagne script writing from our producer Thomas Lewis there to our final story on this evening's Midori House, which is our daily review segment, which where we usually go through the best in books, theatre, art, music, cinema, etc. with our contributors around the world. But today we are talking film, and more specifically we're discussing the Oscars, which are happening on Sunday. Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to film expert and the Nate Silver of the cinema world, Karen Krasanovich, about her predictions for the event.
It's very easy when you're on the other side of the world to say, oh, I know what's going on in Hollywood, because the Oscars are not really, they're a global phenomenon, but the voters are not. So we may think that we know that something is sewn up, that so-and-so is going to win. But the minute you start thinking that way with the Oscars, you're going to run into trouble. And this is why, despite the fact that it's not chic, I encourage people to see what the bookies are saying, because the bookies, I don't know, they usually get things pretty right.
Well, let's start with one of the main categories, Best Actor.
Yes, yes. This is the McConaughey, they're calling it, the renaissance of Matthew McConaughey. He is absolutely amazing, having lost an enormous amount of weight. That's not all there is to it. There's also a real trick of the light that he's doing with his portrayal of the AIDS sufferer who goes to Mexico and brings these drugs back. It's based on a true story. And he does turn in a remarkable performance.
And I have to say, I know DiCaprio is not even the second favorite. I believe that's probably Chiwetel for 12 Years a Slave. But I did like his performance.
It's an amazing... I haven't been a big fan of DiCaprio. He's a good actor, don't get me wrong. He's a movie star. But he really brings it back from the brink in this film, which is beautifully written, incredibly funny. I sat with a bunch of very hardened film critics, and we laughed so hard we cried, and that never happens. And he really made me like the role. He liked, and I thought it really gave him an opportunity to act. I don't think he has a lot of opportunities for that.
And in the case of the telephone, it's up to each and every one of you, my highly trained Strattonites. My killers who will not take no for an answer. My fucking warriors who will not hang up the phone until their client either buys or fucking dies!
Now moving on, Best Actress. I mean, so far everybody was saying Kate Blanchett will win this. But, you know, we've heard some little stories about Woody Allen. And, I mean, do you think this will affect anyhow or?
I really think that the timing of the accusations against Woody Allen were designed to hurt him at the Oscars. And whether it's true or whether it's not, I think the point that we have to remember, as with other directors like... Roman Polanski, et cetera, I think we really have to focus on the work. And Kate Blanchett was getting sort of a mealy-mouthed little thing at the BAFTAs about this. The real interesting story here is that Kate Blanchett is very, very strong and the favorite, but people really love Sandra Bullock. And she turns in an amazing, if weightless, performance in Gravity.
Houston in the blind. This is Mission Specialist Ryan Stone, reporting from the Shenzhou. I'm about to undock from Tiangong. And I have a bad feeling about this mission. Reminds me of a story, Houston. Never mind the story, Houston. Never mind the story. It's getting hot in here.
Talking about the global thing, you know, we're talking Kate Blanchett, Australian, now we're going for Mexican, who is the favorite for Best Director.
Yes.
That's going to be a very interesting competition to see who's going to win, Alfonso or Steve McQueen, or Alfonso has the lead on that.
Yes, absolutely. I think what's going to happen is that Alfonso Cuarón will win Best Director for Gravity, because it is technically an achievement, an amazing achievement. And I think Steve McQueen, who... Turner Prize-winning artist, gone on to make incredibly important movies like Shame, has had this breakthrough film, which is an important film that is now going to be taught in schools. And I think that if that doesn't get Best Picture, then that's a problem.
Can I speak of what did not occur?
Oh, Master Black!
Bro!
Master!
You come here.
Master Anthony!
Master, come here!
I brought her back just like you.
Come here!
Master!
Master, I got it. This is distracting. Master,
you stay away from Pat's boy.
Master.
That that's what we're going to talk. I think that's probably the category that we're almost sure that that's going to be the winner, 12 Years a Slave.
Yes, I hope so, because I really think it is important. But then again, the Mandela movie, A Long Walk to Freedom, is an important movie. And Idris Elba's performance in that was incredibly important. And the Fruitvale Station, again, was a very, very important film. And so things, you know, can go for walks.
Karen, before we wrap, what do you think about this new decision of the Oscars to have, I mean, it didn't start this year, but it started in the last 2 years, I believe, to have like nine or 10 films in the best film category. To be honest, I prefer when I used to like when it was only five. It was easier.
It was easier. That's an old rule that they brought back, that I can't remember what year that had been in before. I think it's quite good, and I think the reason they're doing it is to make the running a little more interesting. They've limited the number of producers on Best Picture, and they've changed a lot of the smaller rules. But no, I think it's better. It makes more people want to go to the movies, so that's good.
That was Karen Krasanovich talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and that is all for today's edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up, The Menu with Marcus Hippie, where we'll be finding out about a Cuban restaurant in Alabama that's serving up its dishes in a car wash. No, really. I'll be back at 2200 hours London time for The Daily with Emma Nelson. This show returns at the same time on Monday, but for now, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.